I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Joining me now is a noted Canadian author, Denise Chong, who, for the first time in a decade, returns with a new book, Egg on Mao, the story of an ordinary man who defaced an icon and unmasked a dictatorship. It is a compelling book that tells the story of Liu Dixing, a small-town mechanic who saw through the communists' rule in China. He and a couple of friends traveled to Beijing at the height of the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989, 20 years ago earlier this summer, and with paint-filled eggs pelted the famed portrait of Chairman Mao. They're jailed, but that's not the end of the story. What follows is an account of Liu's life, as well as a view onto China during those years of protest and beyond. Denise Chong is the author of two previous books, The Concubine's Children and The Girl in the Picture. They were prize winners and big bestsellers. Egg on Mao is published by Random House in Vancouver this day. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Denise Chong. Good morning, Ms. Chong.
Good morning.
I was seven when all this happened in 1989, and though I remember the guy who stood in front of the tank until I picked up your book, I didn't know about Liu. Before we get into why, what he did and why he did it, what was his background? He was a mechanic?
He was not, in other words, a student who were among the tens of thousands that occupied the square and poured into Beijing from the provinces. He was not an intellectual which viewed the students and their movement and hoped that the democracy movement would spread beyond the students. He was a bus mechanic. He was in his mid-20s. He was from a small political backwater, a river town in Hunan province, 1,500 kilometers from Beijing, but also deep in the heart of Mao country. This was the province where Mao was born, where the communist movement was born, about 60 years before. So he came, in other words, from what would be called, there's a communist phrase, good roots and shoots. In other words, he had his good communist background, and offspring of communists are supposed to be able to judge, you know, how to act like a good communist, how to protect the revolution.
So was he indifferent then to the cause?
He was at first. He watched the students amassing in the square, and his first instinct was that this was a regime that paid no heed to public attention. Numbers would mean nothing. What the students, their placards that they raised calling for democracy, anti-corruption, would have no impact on the leadership. But then came the pivotal moment, which also captured the world attention, when the students, in about their fifth week of the protest, started a hunger strike. And this was a slap in the face of the regime, but it also got world attention. And like everyone around China and the world looked on their television sets, saw people, children, students in other words, willing to risk their lives for the future of their country. And then he gets swept up in the hope and optimism that China is on the brink of change. It can possibly go from being an authoritarian government and society to the democracy. So like those that jammed on the trains heading for Beijing, even though they had to climb through the windows, he gets on board with his idea that he wants to be in the square to support the students.
Before we get into once he's in the square, in his life previous to all this, he had seen, I guess, the dark side of the regime. He and his wife were pregnant, and what's the deal? It was an unauthorized pregnancy. Is that what they called it?
They called it words even more coldly than that. He sees as a young child, Liu Dixing, he's fed stories by his grandmother, who was actually what's called a martyr's widow, because her husband was a confidant of Mao, and he was executed by Mao's archenemy. But he hears these stories from his grandmother about Mao's bullying ways, and his grandmother kind of plants a seed that submission and yoking yourself to authority is not the way to stand up for oneself and know one's own mind. But he keeps it all quiet to himself until really the turning point is when the regime strikes deep into his own daily life and cuts deeply into his own heart when he's a teenager runs away with the love of his life, another teenager, and that's when the neighborhood busybodies swing into action. They want that relationship broken up. When it turns into a marriage, they're underage to be married. The local authorities say this is a non-marriage. You're too young to be married. They want to undo that marriage. Then when they become pregnant, how can you have a child from a non-marriage? So then they say this is a non-authorized birth because of the one-child policy, and they demand an abortion. So it's when you're right, that's the darker side of what he sees of daily life under this regime, and it's his determination to do as he chooses, to live with the love of his life, to live together, to proceed with the pregnancy and have the child, that ultimately leads to his own, I guess, political awakening, that one has to stand up for one's rights, even if, in effect, it can be futile.
So he's on the train, he's on his way to Tiananmen Square. Was his motive to go there and do something rash, like deface the picture?
No. His intention with his friends from his hometown, and he's the one who's not the intellectual, the other is, one is a teacher, and the other is a arts editor at the local daily newspaper. Their intention is simply to show support for the students. They have devised their own political slogans to advocate for democracy, so they simply want to go in the square, and instead of just watching from on TV, and remember they live in this political backwater, a little river town where it's hard to get anything but party information, so they're not on the telephone to the hotline where university students are relaying information by fax, by phone. So they don't have that access, so they want to go to the heart of the action and be able to see for themselves this movement that's for democracy in Beijing. When they arrive, martial law is imposed by the regime. The regime, in other words, showing impatience after 6 weeks of occupation by the students, impose martial law, and then the three of them fear the students who are sitting in the square to occupy it. The three of them fear that the regime has on its mind only a brutal solution. And fearing that, the three of them think, what can we do? What can we do to warn the students that this is the only language that the regime will speak? What can we do to wake the students up? And they sit in despair, thinking there is nothing we can do. And then they hit upon this idea when they're sitting in the square at midnight and they look at Mao's portrait shining in the dark. It's lit at night. And they hit on the idea that if they do the startling action of marring the portrait, the students will see that the regime is as flawed as the portrait is flawed. So it's only that they come to that act out of frustration. They have no intent. They don't go to Beijing with that intention.
So once they deface the portrait, how did the people there, how did they react to it?
The day began when, you know, students would roll out of bed in the morning and rub the sleep from their eyes out of their tents in the square, ready to begin another day's occupation. The army trucks and what would be tanks eventually remain on the outskirts of Beijing on this fourth day of martial law, but the citizens of Beijing are quite emboldened that there's no military vehicles within the city, so they start pouring into the square for another day of, they're really not afraid at all because they don't expect the troops to attack by day, if they attack at all. The three of them go to the portrait midday. Their last stop before there is to stop at a food vendor to get their eggs. They prepare these eggs with emptying them, then putting paint and turpentine and mixing it into a mixture. And when they lob every one of the 30 eggs, to their surprise, they are stunned that they've managed to do it all, because in anticipating and planning their act, they fully expect the possibility of being shot to death on the spot by what the Chinese know, that there are plainclothesmen throughout the square, as they are in daily Chinese life.
Right.
What they don't anticipate is what actually happened, which was that the students surrounded them and turned them into police.
What did that mean to them? Were they betrayed, obviously?
Betrayal. And they never expected that the students would not think as they did. Now, it may be naivety on their part that they didn't see that the students were as fearful that such an action would anger the regime. Naivety on their part, perhaps. But what they came to realize eventually, within days, because then they sat in jail, and of course they don't know, unlike you or I would have known, even watching TV and seeing the Tiananmen Square aftermath of the brutal crackdown. They don't know, sitting in jail, that crackdown has happened. They just see a sudden coldness and a change of attitude on the part of the regime, where the regime is at first, wondering about their action and what the meaning is, and it turns like that, and the regime becomes very back to hardline, hectoring communists, and they fully fear that they will be sentenced to death.
Now, were you, in 1989, were you there?
I was originally in China, living there in the mid-80s, when the first student protests happened and were quickly put down by the regime. And so really that was the second wave of protests in 1989. I wasn't there, although my husband was a journalist at the time and covered it. And so I didn't return to China until I researched my first book, My Family Story, and then I returned again to China 2 years ago to research this story.
It just seems, looking back in history, that 1989 was such a pivotal year, that something turned on its head, something changed. When you were there in the mid-80s, did you sense that was about to happen?
There are many who would see periods of the 1980s, and I'm talking, let's say, even about Tibetans, where there's been a crackdown, intellectuals, students, minorities would say in the mid-80s that there was a relaxation, and that there seemed to be genuine cause for hope and optimism. Since then, an economic miracle has happened, and that's really not an exaggeration. So there is astounding changes that have happened in China. Great material well-being has come to the Chinese that they wouldn't have imagined in so short a time. But it would be folly to think that those sorts of changes have been accompanied by change that the Chinese people really want to see, which is a capacity, an ability, a freedom to speak what's on your mind, to hold one's belief, to not worry about the wrong kind of thinking, to not worry about protesting against the regime, in other words, just to disobey or to have dissident views, which the regime doesn't tolerate today, just as it didn't tolerate then.
Where do you suppose they're headed?
Well, you certainly hear from the West eruptions of public discontent in China, and it comes now through television, the internet. You see pictures of, whether it's Xinjiang ethnic unrest, you see bereaved parents of earthquake victims whose, their children have been, the primary school has collapsed in the earthquake because of shoddy building codes. You hear about protests, you hear about even something like, people storming a police station, people protesting against taxes. So these are the small little eruptions that you hear. So the question is whether in the West we can reconcile that with our language about how do you engage China in human rights? How do we deal with abuse of human rights violations? So really I just wanted to put the human back into human rights and put a face on it and bring us back to what it is that we're advocating for about the morality of this condition of being having humanity, being a human being.
Now, when Liu and his friends were in prison, were they harmed?
The other two were regarded as intellectuals, and the regime treated them harshly. Solitary confinement, which is like what the prisoners would call a dog cave. It was so dark, damp, small, and where rations would be cut in half, and grueling and damaging to your health. Beatings. One of them was beaten within 2 years of his being in prison, and he remains mentally incapacitated today. Oddly, Luda Cheng, who was but a bus mechanic, was treated comparatively leniently. But at the same time, when I tell his story, you see that whether he was in society growing up in his little river town or confronting the neighborhood busybodies who trying to get his wife to have an abortion, or whether he's entrapped in the state apparatus of prison and guards and harsh physical labor, he stands up for his rights. He tries to defend his rights there as much as he did in living as, in society in his own hometown. And so there was a lesson again that if you don't defend those rights, they will. It's those sorts of accumulating indignities that ultimately lead to the abuse of human rights. So his, again, is an interesting case even behind the prison walls.
So he serves 9 years, and he gets out. And how long was he supposed to be in prison for?
He received the lightest sentence at 16 years. His two friends received life imprisonment and 20 years. But even the phrase that you use, he gets out, he certainly, none of them were released for
good behavior.
Justice. No, yeah. We're not free. Because they were, China had other motives. It was this, you know, this language I called of engagement with the West. They were used as, but China had other interests at heart. If they released a high-profile political prisoner, it would help them make progress on wooing Western business, on engaging the West, on, you know, material well-being for both the West and for China. So they were but, and also China was bidding for the Olympic Games in Beijing. And so as these political prisoners, who would all become democracy activists in exile, because China would whisk them out of the country, were but pawns in this game to kind of appease the West.
How did he end up in Canada? He lives in Calgary now, does he?
He lives in Calgary. He has his wife and his son with him, who also escaped from China just over a year ago. He was released from prison, went to back to his hometown, no job, no roof over his head, took to driving a taxi, finding whatever he could do to make his living, had to report once a week to the police, once a month to the National Security Bureau. And he feels the weight of surveillance and monitoring. And then, with great planning, one day, literally walks on foot out of town, on foot makes his way through the jungles of Burma, through Thailand, and makes his way there, where the Chinese, at the behest of the Chinese, the Thais actually jail him for 18 months because he's engaging in democracy activism there. And then on the brink of being deported back to China, the UN and the Canadian government step in, and he became obtained political asylum and came to Calgary. And so that gave me the entree to this story.
I read somewhere that he's in poor health now.
I think I can say this. He has he's being treated for thyroid cancer, and for most likely this probably relates to the difficult food and hygiene conditions in prison, drinking the water where the water had a metallic taste to it and was not boiled from food prepared under unsanitary conditions. And I mean, prisoners didn't know whether they could even survive prison health unless there were ways to under the table to get fresh food and get relatives to help. So he's been treated for thyroid cancer, but there is a good chance of recovery from that, a good success rate. He doesn't have work. It's hard to speak, hard for him to learn English. And most of all, it's the sadness I think he has that while he's achieved freedom and he thanks himself every day for having being in Canada, there's the sadness of being separated for maybe the rest of his life from his family in China, from his home, from his society that he still holds so much hope for.
Now, I read that the I also read that the other two guys are in the United States. They were supposed to be reunited in June. Did that happen?
Yes, it did. Yu Dongyue and Yu Jiajian, both also with Lu Decheng's help, also escaped from China, making their way into Thailand. And at the intervention of human rights activists in the United States, made their way in May to Indiana. They live in Indiana, and the three of them were united on the 20th anniversary of Tiananmen Square on June 4th in Washington. And that was the first time that the three of them had been together since they were first imprisoned 20 years ago.
I want to ask something personal now, because I find it fascinating after reading about you. And I remember I first read about you before the books was the that citizenship speech that you gave in 1995.
Yes.
I've read that in books in the Sword and Collections. You were born in Vancouver. You were raised in Prince George. I asked Wason Choi this when he was on the program, because my parents are Filipino and I was born here.
Yeah.
And I don't feel a particular attachment to the country of my parents. When you lived in China, did you you lived there for a while, a couple of years, few years? Did you feel anything in terms of a closeness to the country because your ancestors were from there?
In a word, no. No, if anything, it reinforced my sense that I was Canadian. I tried to feel something, if only because all good wishes that were sent with me suggested that I should, you know, lift up my feet and find my Chinese roots.
Right.
And no, if anything, it reinforced my sense of being, my staunch sense of being Canadian. That said, I did meet family. And family, there's a complexity, of course, to family that you feel an attachment to. And so yes, that reach across continents and generations happened with family. But when I come back to Canada, that to me is what Canada makes Canada, you know, I'd rather have a complicated life or citizenship than a simple one. And that's what makes Canada so wonderful. You can have this, you can or cannot have an attachment, say, to your Filipino ancestry or my Chinese ancestry, and still maintain a fierce attachment to being Canada. And it still makes you equally, it doesn't take away from being Canadian.
Denise, this is such a pleasure to talk to you after all these years of reading your work and reading about you. This is a remarkable story that you've written. It's a wonderfully written book. Congratulations on it, and continue good luck.
Thank you, Joe.
You're very welcome. The book is called Egg on Mao, the story of an ordinary man who defaced an icon and unmasked a dictatorship. Denise Chong, its author, on the line. It's published by Random House in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponto.